Welcome to Soundings, a weekly cultural affairs program featuring conversations and commentary from the National Humanities Center. Major funding for this program comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Additional support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas.
Freedom and Religion, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me now for a conversation with John T. Noonan, Jr., judge of the United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit.
What was at issue was the use of peyote by believers in the native Indian religion. They used it in Oregon, where it was a state crime to use peyote. Consequently, they lost their jobs, and they were not eligible for employment benefits because they had engaged in misconduct of this kind. And they claim that they have...
Judge John T. Noonan, Jr., although the United States was the first modern nation whose constitution protected the free exercise of religion, Americans have hardly resolved the competing personal and social claims of free speech, individual conscience, and religious practice. During his recent visit to the National Humanities Center, Judge John T. Noonan, Jr. lectured on the free exercise of religion in America. I asked Judge Noonan to describe the state of the question.
Well, Wayne, there was a very dramatic decision just a year ago, a case called Employment Division against Smith, which has been described by the dissenters as a wholesale overturning of 50 years of precedent. In this case, certainly sharply limited the meaning of the free exercise of religion clause that is part of our Bill of Rights.
All right, what was at issue here?
What was at issue was the use of peyote by believers in the native Indian religion. They used it in Oregon, where it was a state crime to use peyote. Consequently, they lost their jobs, and they were not eligible for employment benefits because they had engaged in misconduct of this kind. And they claim that their use of peyote was protected by the free exercise clause because the peyote was the central sacrament of the native Indian religion. The Supreme Court, in a 5-4 decision, held that free exercise did not extend to use of this drug. That was the narrow holding, but the major holding was that any generally valid, neutral law of the state trumps the claim of free exercise.
All right, now we've got a lot of history going on here, and we have to make some distinctions. Let's move back in time, Judge John Noonan. Tell me about the difference between the free exercise of religion, freedom of conscience, free speech, freedom of worship. How do we arrive at those distinctions as we look back at the evolution of American law?
Well, I think that free thought and freedom of conscience have to precede free exercise. A free exercise of religion means at least the ability to worship a divine being in the way your conscience dictates. You don't reach that without having freedom of conscience and freedom of thought. So those three freedoms go together. Freedom of religion and freedom of speech are very close, and to some extent freedom of speech can swallow up or blanket freedom of religion, because most acts of religion turn out to be one or another form of speech. But we can go into that. The protection that the United States Constitution gave freedom of religion was unique in history as far as any nation is concerned.
The United States was the first country to do this.
The first country. There were precedents in what had happened within the preceding 20 years in the new states, Virginia and Massachusetts in particular. But of course, they weren't countries. It was unprecedented for a nation to renounce establishment of any religion and to guarantee free exercise of religion. We embarked on a really noble experiment.
Well, we had a noble experiment going at least until, the early and the mid part of the 19th century, and along come the Mormons, and they want to practice polygamy. What happened there? Tell me about the legal circumstances and the historical circumstances.
Well, the Mormons represented a form of Christianity that was anathema to the main line Christian churches, because the Mormons accepted and indeed insisted on the duty of plural marriage for Mormon males. The result was strong political and religious opposition to the Mormons, resulting in a series of laws passed by Congress attempting to suppress the polygamy and the Mormon Church along with it if the Church did not abandon polygamy.
It wasn't before our recording session here and your lecture here at the Humanities Center, Judge Noonan, you said it wasn't just suppression. It was an all-out effort, in effect, to destroy the Church on the basis of the practice of polygamy. Have I got that right?
That's right. The culminating act of Congress confiscated the property of the Church. And the congressman supporting that made it very clear that the object was to extirpate the Church because it was the sponsor of this particular moral doctrine.
All right, so and what is it, around 1890, we have the issuing of the so-called manifesto by the Mormons. They say, all right, we'll stop practicing polygamy.
Well, the manifesto came after the Supreme Court of the United States had upheld the congressional enactment.
Uh-huh. What happened then?
And in the Mormon cases, the Supreme Court every time had upheld the act of Congress against the free exercise claims mm-hmm. that the Mormons were making. Well, then the Mormon doctrine had always been understood by the Church to mean plural marriage, circumstances permitting. And then the president of the Church, after the Supreme Court decision, said circumstances no longer permit the practice of polygamy. That was the that was the manifesto.
All right, now we've moved backward in time, Judge Noonan. Let's move forward in time. There are still, 50, 60, 70,000 people practicing polygamy in parts of Utah, New Mexico, Arizona, Colorado, Idaho, and yet we do not have this concerted persecution of the Church. Now, these are not members of the mainline Mormon Church. They are splinter groups, fundamentalists, but in legal terms, the government leaves them alone. Why is this?
Well, the last effort by the government in this area occurred in the 1940s in enforcing the Mann Act, the so-called White Slave Act, against transportation over state lines of women who were in polygamous marriages. I understand that persecution or prosecution was instigated by the mainline Mormon Church, and the federal authorities successfully carried it out in a prosecution that was sustained by the Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
So as of 50 years ago, the Free Exercise Clause was not good to sustain a claim against a federal law. Now, I think that what's happened now is there's just not very much pressure to do anything about this fairly small group of people.
Not so much a religious thing as a social thing. And if you just sort of keep to yourself, then the government isn't going to bother you.
The government certainly hasn't anyway.
Yeah. Let's talk, Judge John Noonan, about the limits of the law and what we mean, again, by the free exercise of religion. What do Americans have in mind when they use terms like the public interest, national government, national religion, and national identity? How do those terms converge or diverge with respect to this notion of the free exercise?
Well, sociologically speaking, there's much to be said for Durkheim's theory that the religion of the nation is what holds the government together, and you can't have a nation without some kind of tacit set of symbols.
Oh, now wait, we don't combine church and state,
we
and
don't.
Yet you're telling me that we do?
Well, de facto, the main national goals operate the way a religion would, and I think, in fact, the record is perfectly clear that whenever the national interest, as embodied in an act of Congress, has been opposed to a free exercise claim by some particular member of a church, the national interest has triumphed. The Mormon cases begin the saga, but to take more recent cases, you've had cases of the Amish claiming to be exempt on religious grounds from Social Security. You've had believers in, claiming that they're not subject to federal income taxation. You've had conscientious objectors to the draft. All those classes of people have put their religion up against the national interest, and the national interest has been upheld to the detriment of their own exercise of religion.
How have the courts defined the practice of religion, or the term religion itself? Are there a set of criteria to which a group or an individual would have recourse to figure out that in fact he or she or they are practicing a religion?
It's a very difficult area. The closest the courts come to doing it is not in terms of the Constitution, but in terms of the draft laws that did give exemption to believers in total pacifism if they were motivated by religion. And the court there treated religion as not only the standard mainline church's view of religion, but anything that was the functional equivalent.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever was the functional equivalent of God, that is, as a supreme value in a person's life, was treated as creating the functional equivalent of religion.
Well,
but it's a very difficult area for a court to get into, because in defining religion, they express their own theology.
Right. You could be talking about purely idiosyncratic, if not individual, tendencies. My question becomes, isn't this country really incoherent in the way that we define religion and the free exercise of religion? Because we're talking on the one hand about a national identity, on the other hand we're talking about something that is intensely personal.
Well, that's right. And those two definitions, one of them is Durkheim's, the national consciousness as religion. The other is William James's. William James' view as viewed religion as the solitary expression of the spirit. And I do think that there's an absolute split here. I've compared it to singing. One group thinks singing is what you do in a choir.
Right.
The other thinks singing is what you do in a shower. And I think James is one view, Durkheim is another, and they have to be put together. But in general, they've not been put together in the legal treatment of the subject.
Uh-huh. Judge John Noonan, what brings on the litigation? If I'm practicing what I call religion off by myself and I don't bug anybody, here we're back to that notion of my rights end at the tip of your nose and all of that. What is it that stimulates the legal activity that in turn leads to these definitions that we live with, comfortably or not?
Well, one kind of litigation that I'm afraid is inescapable is if there's a split in the church and then there's an argument between the two factions over who gets the property.
Uh-huh.
Now, unless they're going to fight it out physically, they've got to go to court. And so in that kind of case, you have a court coming in, making decisions, and in fact establishing a religion, because it has to choose one or the other side as the true owners, the true church owning the property. So that's a kind of inevitable involvement of courts in religion in a way that involves them rather deeply in religion, despite the efforts of the Supreme Court to say that they're not involved. All right, and another kind is when the government comes to the conclusion that some kind of fraud is going on.
Hmm.
And because it's a very delicate matter for the government to come in and say that people who are purporting to be religious are in fact practicing something like mail fraud.
No, wait. You're talking about fraud in terms of other people beyond the closed circle itself, not just infighting.
Well, not just infighting, but it's certainly the people who are being defrauded are the people who are paying money to the people who are purporting to be religious.
Are you talking about our television evangelists?
Well, that's a case where the actual religious doctrines were not at issue. The more difficult case was the ballot case, which involved a religious movement called the I Am movement, where the government, in effect, said the doctrines being taught by the ballads were untrue, or just false statements about their conversations with Jesus Christ and other figures of the past. Now, that involved the government in a direct challenge to to religious doctrine.
All right, and how was that resolved?
It was resolved by saying the government can't test the truth, but it can test the sincerity of the teachers of this particular doctrine. That's a very fine line, perhaps an impossible line to draw between sincerity and truth.
And sincerity got judged against what kinds of standards in that case?
Well, it was just a question, do these people really believe what they're saying?
Uh-huh.
And it was left to a jury to say whether they really believed it or not. That's a rather difficult decision for a jury to be asked to make.
Mm-hmm. Where do the pressures come from, Judge Noonan, when we talk about litigation and the free exercise of religion? Do they come from special interest groups, individuals, the government picking on groups or being picked on? How does that work?
Well, I suppose if you think quantitatively, the largest area of litigation has been over schools, over aid to parochial schools by state governments, and over the appearance of any religious activity in the public schools. And the school area is so special, so marked off from any other area, that some of the rules that apply in the main area don't seem to apply in the school area.
Well, now, where do we stand now? For example, if a church group wants to come in and use a portion of a school, that is to say the physical setting, what is the government thinking these days?
Well, the Congress passed the Free Access Act, Free or Equal Access Act, which applies only to federally schools receiving federal funding,
mm-hmm.
that entitles any group to come in and have a discussion on the school premises. If the school is open to any discussion group, they have to be open to a religious group.
So it isn't the value or the worth of your ideas as a religion, it's the accessibility of the facility to everybody.
That's right. It's an open forum, and they say you can't exclude religion from the open forum.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that is an interesting change from what the Supreme Court had said must be the rule 45 years ago, that you can't have religious discussion or meetings on public school property.
Strict separation of church and state.
That was a much stricter separation.
Mm-hmm. What about the problem of abortion? And I understand that you don't want to comment about specific cases that may be in front of the Supreme Court, or in fact that you may be sitting in judgment upon right now. But how do we figure out what goes on between abortion and the free exercise of religion? Again, the state of the question, so to speak.
Well, the strongest effort in this area was made in a case called Harris against McRae, which involved the federal the lack of federal funding for abortion. And it was claimed by the persons who wanted the federal funding that was an establishment of religion to deny it. In other words, they tried to show that the motives of the congressman who had voted and led the fight to deny federal funding were religious. And the Supreme Court rejected that line of argument, saying you can't inquire into the motives of congressmen. And moreover, there are many coincidences between the legislation Congress or a state adopts and religious tenets, beginning with, of course, the familiar prohibitions on murder or theft. They coincide with religious doctrines. It doesn't mean that they are the enactment of them.
What about the free exercise of religion and, shall we call it, an imposition of a public morality? I think back to the days of prohibition. Is it profitable to think analogously about prohibition and questions of abortion and free exercise today?
Well, I think you'll find that religious groups and churches have always been very active in American history in promoting their views of public morality. Now, the great examples, of course, are the go back to the 19th century with the slavery, that it was only due to the action of Congregationalist ministers that a strong abolitionist group grew up, and you had a party that was devoted to abolishing slavery. That was a religious intervention of the most serious magnitude in our country. I've mentioned the Mormon example. That also was promoted by Congregationalist and Methodist ministers in particular. Then in the 20th century, you have the example of Prohibition that you've mentioned, the Methodists being the leaders in that. And then the great civil rights movement of the 60s was largely the work of the Black Baptist Church, of whom, of course, Martin Luther King is a notable leader. So that again and again, you have had religions promoting their view of public morality and, in fact, imposing it when they were successful, as they were in the case of the abolitionists and the other instances I've mentioned.
Do we talk, Judge John Noonan, about the free exercise of religion in terms of, to come back to this question of a national identity, the sort of mainstream, the way Americans live, or do we always resolve these questions on the fringe, at these very perilous extremes of our social life? Liquor, abortion, polygamy, things like that.
Well, by and large, I think that's apt to be the case, because if the people in general are in agreement, there's not going to be much litigation. So that it is, in a way, the more difficult, the more extreme issues that are going to present at least the issues for litigation. I think that the Free Exercise Clause and the Establishment Clause both operate without any litigation to create a very substantial area of mutual respect in this country. I think that, in a way, I see that as their most important role, that they've set the framework mm-hmm. where you don't need litigation to live and live together quite amicably.
At the time that we're recording this conversation, Judge John Noonan, we've just been subjected to another national survey, a poll, which says that Americans really are very dishonest. They lie a lot. There's no real genuine public morality out there. What do you think as you look at this question of American life and the free exercise of religion? Is this a religious country? Some people say it's a Christian nation. What about that?
Well, I wouldn't say that, but I would say it is a remarkably diverse nation. I really believe that religion has flourished in this country as it has not flourished anywhere else on earth, and it's flourished clearly without much government support. You can, of course, find exceptions that you can to everything, but on the whole, compared to other countries, and certainly the past countries and past history, we've done religion. Churches have flourished in peace without people killing each other for religion, and it's been I think a wholesome area for different religious groups to grow up.
Here's a footnote to our conversation, Judge John Noonan. Let me get personal for a moment here. You were raised as a Catholic. You earned degrees from Catholic institutions. I won't press you for an answer as to whether you're a practicing Catholic.
Well, go ahead.
Well, how about this relationship yes. between where you sit as an appeals court judge and the free exercise of religion? How do you figure out the difference between what you are and what you believe and the way you tease those threads into or keep them separate from the judgments that you make?
Well, I should say, Wayne, that I have been and am a Catholic, and I'm quite conscious. I think that it's important to be conscious of what one's beliefs are, otherwise they will infect your judgment unawares. But I have not found any conflict. Of course, I can't anticipate what would happen, but I've taken an oath to observe the Constitution of the United States, and I've never seen a case where there was a conflict between that obligation and any obligation of conscience. Now, I think if a judge does reach that point where there is a conflict, he obviously ought to recuse himself from the case. But at least in my 5 years' experience, that question's not been presented.
All right, and a final question here, a quick one for you, Judge John Noonan. Would you look ahead a little bit? What are we going to be fighting about over the next 10 or 15 years when it comes to the free exercise of religion?
Well, that's an area of prophecy where I don't know the judges have particularly, but I think probably, to give you the case that I'm sure is going to come up within a few years, are school vouchers. School vouchers used by the parents of the children and used to send the children to parochial schools. And that's going to be a very interesting case where the precedents are pretty evenly divided as to whether that would constitute an establishment of religion or whether it would be a perfectly appropriate free exercise of religion.
Mm-hmm. Judge John T. Noonan, it's been a pleasure to have you as a visitor at the National Humanities Center, and I wish you well in your work.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure being and talking with you.
John T. Noonan, Jr. is judge of the United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit. During his recent visit to the National Humanities Center, Judge Noonan lectured on the free exercise of religion. You're listening to Soundings, a weekly cultural affairs program featuring conversations and commentary from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Soundings on Freedom and Religion is available on cassette. For a copy of the preceding discussion, send $5 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, the zip code 27709. Please ask for program number 582. That's program number 582. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, the zip code 27709. Send $2 for a complete listing of Soundings discussions available on cassettes. And when you write, please mention the call letters of this radio station. The National Humanities Center is eager to hear your comments about Soundings.
You've been listening to Soundings, a weekly cultural affairs program featuring conversations and commentary from the National Humanities Center. Next week, listen for a discussion about early Roman history and culture. Wayne Pond will talk with Richard Talbert of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and with Susan Trajari of Stanford University.
This, after all, is a society where it's very hard to pass on, to gain new wealth except through inheritance. It's, after all, not a very capitalist society in a modern sense. It certainly isn't industrialized.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also a very competitive and snobbish society, so that status, both high and low, matters a great deal to people.
It sounds to me like women would really...
Thanks for listening to Soundings. Partial support for this program comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Major funding for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Freedom and Religion, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me for a conversation with John T. Noonan, Jr., judge of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit. Although the United States was the first modern country whose constitution protected the free exercise of religion, Americans have hardly resolved the competing claims of freedom of speech, freedom of conscience, and the practice of religion. Where, in fact, should we look for guidelines? Freedom and Religion, some answers and insights from the National Humanities Center, this week on Soundings.